Welcome to Bee's Table Talk, the podcast in which we have great conversations about business and our economy. My name is Bee Kyle. I'm the president and CEO of the St. Paul Area Chamber, and I'm so glad that you've joined us. I love these conversations. It's my opportunity to talk with leaders among us, share the great things they're doing and how they think, which resonate with me and I think will with you as well. And this year, I'm delighted to invite our sponsor for this podcast, Wells Fargo. Now, this organization has a legacy of extraordinary engagement in this region, and they're investing in their priorities through their work and through their individual leaders. And I'm delighted that they choose this organization and frankly, this platform to support. So more to come on that. And now quickly into the fun reason for the program today, which is my guest. And this is someone you will know maybe more by the organization she leads than necessarily her. She's one of these quiet wonders. I find her to be insightful. She's genuine. She's got tremendous strategic vision. And she also has an extraordinary career path that led rather circuitously to her current role as president and CEO of the Minnesota United, Minnesota's professional soccer team. So I am so delighted to welcome my friend, Sherry Ballard. Thanks for coming.
Hi, Bee. And I have to tell you, I think you might be the only person on the planet that would describe me the way that you just did. Very nice. I'm going to try to live up to it, but I think these guys are going to see probably within the first 30 seconds of our discussion. I'm not going to entirely live up to all of that, but thank you. I'm glad to be with you. I of all the discussions we have over breakfast or lunch, if anybody was recording those, there's a lot of stuff there. So it's fun to be able to do it in this format.
Yes, I totally agree. So for the listeners, Sherry and I are good friends. And basically I hounded her to have breakfast with her and then I won't let her go. And so we meet regularly and we just talk about life and how we think about business and how we approach hard issues. And, you know, as we all know, the easy stuff's done. So what we wrestle with every day is hard stuff. And we just, I don't know, we give each other counsel and encouragement and it's been wonderful. So I want you all to know Sherry, because I just am, I'm in love with her. She's just fabulous. And you will be too, once you're done hearing from her. So let's talk about you. So from the Minnesota United fan perspective, you suddenly appeared on the scene in 2021. But the truth is you've been a leader in this market for years. And indeed, more than once, you've been named to Fortune magazine's list of the most powerful women in business, which I was very impressed by the way. Five times.
My mom was too. Thank you.
Well, I can be your sister. That's good. Okay. So now Bill McGuire, and when he talks about you, he is quite proud and he considers it to have been a coup to have recruited you. So tell the listeners a little bit about your background.
So before I was with Minnesota United, my entire career was at Best Buy. So I say to folks, and it's true, I spent my whole adult life at Best Buy. I started in 1993 at the Flint, Michigan Best Buy store 411, as the operations manager. And that was in the, you know, very early days of Best Buy, where, you know, the company was still a regional company, if you can even believe that these days, but it was still a regional company. And they were just starting to expand geographically east and we're opening stores in Michigan. And so I joined then, you know, and I thought the thing that attracted me to Best Buy was the really was the people I met. And then I did so many things wrong interviewing for that job that I would like never tell people to do these days. But like I went to the interview, they recruited me. So I went to the interview, not even really knowing anything about the company and not having been any of their stores because there weren't any in Michigan, you know, but I really liked the people a lot that I interviewed with and then drove to Chicago over that weekend. So I could at least see what one of these stores was like. I love the energy and the vibe in the stores. So I joined in 93 and, you know, was hopeful that I would be eventually get to be a store manager and then maybe a district manager.
When I'm a grown up, I get to be a store manager.
Yeah. And if I was good at it, maybe ultimately be a regional manager in some way. And that was sort of how I saw things. And as the world does, and we've certainly talked about it, you know, nothing kind of unfolds as you think it's going to, but I ended up there for 26 years and had a lot of different jobs with the company. And when I left, I was president of the US business and had responsibility for all of our stores in the US, the website, basically any place a customer interacted with Best Buy in the US was some area of my responsibility. Spent some time outside of the US running our international segment, spent time in corporate functions, ran human resources, legal, call centers. So it just ended up being a really marvelous, I mean, it's a great company with really great people. And it was just a marvelous opportunity, I think, to grow sort of with a company. You know, and I've said it in a number of different settings that I think there are certain things that you can only learn, you know, when a company is experiencing certain types of problems. You know, the context, you and I talk about context a lot. Mm-hmm. The context sort of frames, mm-hmm. you know, what you're going to have to learn. Mm-hmm. And being with a company when it was, you know, trying to just get scale and survive all the way to it's, you know, it got so big that it was hard to move anything. And, you know, we almost died because of that through new types of competition, et cetera, and all those different contexts were just a wonderful opportunity to keep learning and growing as a person and as a leader. And so I left there in 2019, thinking I was never going to do another operating job as
I mean, think about what the journey you were on and how Best Buy went global.
Yeah.
And while you were on that train, that's fantastic.
It was just really interesting stuff because, you know, I mean, we were predominant. I mean, I think companies like people have identities and we were predominantly, you know, a United States based, Midwest based, physical retailer at scale. And so we were really good at working with vendors to figure out what the right products were for customers, negotiating the prices well so that we could give customers access to technology at a really affordable price, opening stores, big stores with really good culture. You know, so we were, you know, in kind of more typical marketing, we were really good at, you know, kind of price, assortment, convenience, you know, and experience. And, you know, over 10, and that's how we got big as a company. And it's how we ended up being the dominant and really only specialty retailer of electronics left in the US. You know, but that was before much of the internet, you know, and then that changed everything. And before you know it, you know, you've got Amazon, you know, owning the internet, where if the only thing people needed was access to great products at a great price and really convenient to get them, we didn't have a reason to exist anymore because Amazon was just killing it on those fronts. So, you know, so it was a really interesting time in the company of trying to figure out, you know, like, well, how do you stay relevant to the people you're serving and what other things might they need? Like, what other problems might they be having that you can solve?
See, this is what I love about you. I mean, that's the question. When for you listeners, when Sharon and I started talking today, she's like, how you doing? And I'm like, you know, I'm struggling with a few things. And she says, yeah, you know, you've expressed some gravity this year. And then I listened to Sherry and she says, she turns it around and she asked the question, what other problems might your customers have that need to be solved? That's amazing. You just do that naturally. Well, but
I mean, I think sometimes, and I mean, we had to learn that. And it, you know, when I tell the story of it now, it sounds like it was some, you know, simple process. And it really, it's like most things you learn as a leader, you know, it wasn't. And, you know, and at Best Buy, that was an organization of 100,000 people. So you also were, you know, trying to get an organization to learn. And I think, you know, for Best Buy, fortunately, you know, because we and others had put so much technology into the world and there'd been so much technology innovation, you know, there was a bigger problem customers were then having, which is, I can't figure out how to make this stuff all work together. So the problem sort of moved into, I've got all this technology in my home, and every time I try to, you know, it never all works. And when it doesn't work, I can't figure out whether, you know, is something wrong with my TV? Is my router out? Is it my cable? Like, I can't even problem solve it, let alone if I want to put something new in, how to, you know, so it sort of became this, you know, this need to shift. I mean, obviously Best Buy still sells a lot of product, but it became a need to also shift to how people were trying to use the product.
Yeah.
And then, and then we had to, you know, enhance our capability to actually figure out how to solve that, because that's not how we grew up. And so, you know, from the outside, it sort of looks like a multiple, you know, a multitude of near death experiences, but on the inside, you know, it was, you know, solving customer problems and then finding out that somebody else could solve the same thing and maybe better. And so having to kind of keep evolving and growing. And, you know, whether that's an organization of 100,000 or an organization of 125, which is what I'm in now, or an individual person, you know, learning and growing is a process. It's a process.
Okay. Which of course takes me to my next question, which is, you are bound for beachy shores and Mai Tais in the afternoon. What in the world convinced you to step back into the game literally, and why in the world and the path that you ultimately chose, what was compelling about the opportunity?
Like, why, how soccer? That doesn't seem like men's professional soccer.
Doesn't seem
like a natural extension of consumer electronics at scale in the United States.
Just a bit of a stretch there.
You're such a small thinker, B.
No, exactly. So
when I left Best Buy, if you are, I am too, because I never saw it coming. Well, when I left Best Buy, the reason I left was because at that point, so this was like 2019, I think, Hubert Joly was the CEO at Best Buy, and he was doing a marvelous job by everybody's count as the CEO, and still, you know, very energetic about things and was planning, I think, on being the CEO for a while. And I kind of felt like I had done a lot of stuff at Best Buy and didn't really see myself. And at this point I was running the US business, and it was the second time I had been in that role. I was in it once, then I went and ran international and came back. And I guess kind of felt like, you know, I don't see myself doing this same thing for another, you know, 5 years. And there's not really another thing for me to do. And I also felt like, and I didn't really have good language for it at the time, but just sort of internally felt a little restless. Like, you know, if I'm ever going to do something else, you know, if there's something else I should now be spending my life doing, I won't know what that is if I stay here. I won't.
And you'll be so busy.
I still love Best Buy, and I loved it when I was there. So in certain ways it might've been easy to stay, but, I just over time kind of felt like I should test myself out outside of Best Buy, because I think inside I was maybe a little bit insecure that the only reason my leadership maybe worked was because of the magic of Best Buy. And so I sort of wondered like, if it wasn't the comfort of a place I've been 26 years where they know me and I know them and there's a history and a track record and all that, you know, would the things I have come to believe about leadership apply in other places? But when I left, you know, I said to people, I don't know what I'm going to do. I know one thing for sure that I have to learn, which is I have to get better at understanding what's going on in the community and what the real issues are in the community, and beyond, you know, giving money, which Marianne and I did, but I wasn't spending a lot of time really understanding things, you know, and it just sort of became, you know, kind of clear and clear to me. Like, many of our friends are very involved in the community, either because of their jobs or because of, you know, their own mission and purpose in life, or both. And I would hear them talking about all kinds of different stuff and just would feel like I was an infant in certain ways. You know, like, I felt like if it was a business conversation, I was sort of an adult, you know, like I didn't know the answers, but I could at least hang in the conversation. Whereas with the community stuff, I couldn't even really track on, like, well, why is it that way? Like, what's the problem? How do we fix it? So I knew, and I knew I needed to be a better community citizen, and I needed to put myself in a place where I was going to be forced to learn. So I knew that. but I didn't know what form it would take. And then, you know, as time went, after I left Best Buy, it ended up taking the form of getting on boards, which makes sense because it was, you know, the things that companies were trying to solve, you know, some of that was like thematically similar to what we were trying to solve at Best Buy, you know, where your business model's under pressure, things are changing, et cetera. So it ended up being that the best way for me to try to contribute to the community was to get on boards. And so I was on the board of Ecolab. I was on the board. I still am, actually. Ecolab, Allina Health, the University of Minnesota, and then PetSmart is my retail fix. And it turned out that two of the people who are on the Allina board are also minority owners in Minnesota United FC, which I didn't know. I knew them from the Allina board, and I knew Minnesota United FC because I'd been to a game, but I didn't know there was any connection. And I got a call from both of them one day saying they wanted to talk to me, and they told me they were minority owners. They had just had an ownership meeting. They were looking for a new CEO. They talked about kind of the attributes that they thought they needed in their next CEO. And they wanted to talk to me about it. I was talking to Tim Welsh, and I remember saying to Tim, "Oh, I know a bunch of people. So if you tell me what you're looking for, I can probably
find somebody."
Yeah. And he was like, "No, that's not the idea here." So that started a process, and I got a chance to meet Bill McGuire, who I didn't know, and meet the other owners and learn about soccer and its role in the community and just how community focused the club was and the sport is. Mm-hmm. And so that aspect really attracted me to it. And it's a sport, and I grew up playing sports. I'm a sports maniac. So I love sports. And then when I asked Bill how big the club was, I was like, "How many people is it?" And he said, "Well, Sherry, this is nothing like Best Buy. It's not 100,000 people. It's like 120. And I was like, "Yes, I'm gonna finish up my career sort of the way I started." You know, I started in a retail store where the job of leadership is right in front of you. You know, like, you know everybody, they know you. Mm-hmm. You can see what their strengths are. You can see whether they're in a job that really suits them. Mm-hmm. You can see whether they're connected to the mission. You can see whether the mission is really delivering for you. I mean, you know, like, it's physically all in front of you when you're a store manager. Mm-hmm. And then somewhere between that and 100,000 people,
right,
you know, you don't know everybody anymore. You're still trying to do the same job, but for 100,000 people, but it's just a different endeavor at scale, as you know.
Right.
And I wouldn't trade that for anything, but the scale of it was very attractive to me too. But it was the community aspect, the sport, and then the scale of it that that over time sort of won my heart. So that's a long answer to how I got there, but that's how.
Well, you have won St. Paul's heart too because of your approach. I mean, they chose you for your character more than anything else, and I know that's been a winning combination. So, congratulations again.
I tell people it's a normal job in a lot of ways. You know, it's, you know, we have customers, we have employees, we have facilities, we have, you know, quote unquote, a product. So it's a normal job in a lot of ways, but it, in certain ways, it's, you know, it's not. Like, when I drive to the stadium on Saturday,
it's exciting.
It's like, there is not a person on this planet that's got a better job than me.
Yes, I totally understand. You got a tiger by the tail in terms of the team you're involved with. So
yeah, there's awesome. A lot of really good people.
So with my listeners, I'm stumbling almost because it's like to get all of my thoughts out as I'm talking to Sherry. I'm going to ask you a couple of questions, Sherry, that kind of go down paths that we've gone before in terms of how you think about challenges and problems, because I'm wrestling with this idea a lot lately about perspective is everything.
Okay.
And that something is a challenge, and it could be a good thing or a bad thing. But you don't know. It's simply a challenge because good things and or bad things come out of opportunity and adversity, right? So this whole idea about how you think about challenges and mindset. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. When you're thinking about, is this the worst or the best thing that's happened to me? And this idea about everything worthwhile is uphill. And what are some thoughts that you might have on this whole idea about adversity versus opportunity and mindset?
Well, I think it goes back to the first word you said, which is perspective. I am a very, very strong believer that the story we tell ourselves mm-hmm. about like what's happening in a scenario, the mm-hmm. story we tell ourselves about another person, the story, like how I'm framing something in my head.
Yes.
Ends up setting the parameters for how I'm going to then engage with that.
Mm-hmm.
And that then defines, you know, kind of what I see as potential, what I see as options. It defines in many ways what version of me, you know, I'm going to take into a problem. I've worked a lot over the years with a woman named Jennifer Joss. And I first met Jennifer when I was at Best Buy. She's a leadership coach. At the time, she was working for a consulting company, and that's how I met her. Best Buy did this really cool thing. We were trying to implement a huge change in the stores, and the problem wasn't a technical problem. It was people not understanding it, not buying into it, and not knowing how to do it. So mm-hmm. it was all a human problem. So they brought these industrial psychologists in to teach us how to do change management. Mm. And one of the ways Jennifer thought about that and talked about it was this head, heart, hands model, you know, like how you understand and think about something, whether you believe in it or don't, and then the skills to do it and how that all gets reinforced. And I learned a lot from her about the power in my own power to either sort of derail myself and or other people and or the possibility of a situation singularly based on what I was telling myself. So yeah. Like, for example, if I were dialing into this today and what I was thinking to myself was the story I'm telling myself is, ugh, I don't want to do a podcast. I don't want to talk about this topic. I don't, you know, if I'm, I don't know what, why am I doing with this with B? I don't like B. Like if I had that as my headset, that's going to uh-huh. frame how I come into it.
Right.
This
right.
one was an easy one because I enjoy you. So, you know, when I saw it on the calendar, it's like, oh, this is going to be fun.
Right.
But
right.
the difference in how we, and in the most extreme way, like, and I found this to be true in my career so many times, like if I have a problem with a coworker, more often than not, my framing is messing it up. You know, like I'm going into the meeting with them thinking this person doesn't get it. They don't understand. They're an idiot. They don't. And that then frames, you know, everything I'm doing in the discussion.
Right.
Whereas if I can get to a place of I'm actually curious what they think, I actually do believe they probably know something and see something I don't. We're actually going to try to do this together. There might be 1,000 ways to solve this problem. It doesn't have to be mine. It just needs to get solved. You know, so all of that, I think, I think it's sort of 80% of what drives our view of each other in the world and what our experiences are in it. And whether we find joy in the dailiness of things or whether we don't, I think of almost all of it is the power of our own mind to kind of set the context on that. And so I don't necessarily lead with perspective, but that's exactly what it is. And it's in my opinion, the most powerful tool we have as humans to change any situation that we're finding ourselves in where we're unhappy.
I just like, can't say
start
enough.
Start with mindset then and start with your own mindset and start examining what am I actually saying to myself?
Yes.
And is it true or
is
not
it
true?
Yes.
So,
yes.
So that's what I would say. But oh. I would the point yeah. you're on, and especially in the world today, I mean, you could do 20 podcasts on the topic of perspective or lack yeah. thereof.
Right.
And
right.
what that causes in people in terms of their ability to be the best version of themselves and have meaning and joy.
Yes.
You know, or whether it causes them to be the worst version of themselves where they spend their whole life, you know, making people around them miserable.
Yes, absolutely. And just the fact that we have a lot more. I think it's really important for us to hear we have a lot more control over our joy and that 100%. It isn't about circumstances. It's about approach, you know, and I just couldn't agree more. I think that really.
Well, I mean, it's a little bit of both in that it's real. I mean, it's real and it's realistic that circumstance that, you know, we find ourselves in or that happened to us, that's real and we have emotion about it. But in my view, you know, you don't have to be held hostage to it.
Yeah,
I mean, our
right.
We have a mutual friend in Penny Wheeler. Mm-hmm. And we're friends with her and Margaret, you know, and they still carry it through the hardest thing I think you could imagine going through as a parent, which is losing their child, Olivia. Mm-hmm. And to watch them, mm-hmm. They'll carry it always, mm-hmm. but to watch them, even in that, mm-hmm. be able to find a way to look forward, see possibility, learn to carry Olivia in a different way, mm-hmm. than the physical version of her here, and a forward kind of view of life, mm-hmm. even with that, you know, it just tells you how powerful people can be in shaping what they do with circumstance. Yeah. I mean, that's the most extreme example of it I have in my life. I don't know if I could do it, to be honest, but yeah. They're remarkable. And it's just a really amazing example, I think.
So taking your thinking and then looking to ask you to speak specifically to women leaders and providing some coaching, you know, you were interviewed several years ago now, and you answered a very specific question in a way that I'm going to ask it again. And okay. So our listeners can get the coaching as well, which is, what advice would you give other women who want to leave their mark in business?
Well, I don't exactly know what I said, but I typically say when I get that, the best advice I ever got, so I'm stealing somebody else's advice probably, but it was true. And that is, get really, really clear on what you care about as a leader. Make sure it's something outside of yourself and it's something that's meaningful and matters. And then get ready for the world to test you nonstop on how much you actually mean what you're saying. That's what I would say. I got that from Brad Anderson, who was the CEO at Best Buy. And it was one of those things where at the time, it resonated with me when he said it, because we were going through a lot at Best Buy. And it was a really, really taxing time. On everybody, but it was a taxing time to be a leader there too. And it was just a very difficult context. And so you couldn't really, you couldn't really sort of just slide by, mm-hmm. and, you know, just kind of have everything just, mm-hmm. you know, kind of lay low.
There's
you know,
no such I mean, thing it, as cruise mode for you during
no,
that season.
No, there wasn't. It required leadership and it required a point of view. And I remember, you know, Brad being like, listen, you know, you got to be clear on who you're serving right now. Mm. Who are you serving? Are you serving the board? Are you serving the CEO? Mm. Are you serving the shareholders? Are you serving the employees? Are you serving the customers? Because all those interests are not 100% aligned in this particular moment. Mm-hmm. And they very often aren't. So who are you actually serving? Stay clear on that and then be willing to take the consequences of it, essentially. Mm. And it ended up being such a, just such a clarifier for me, even now, like at times, you know, when you got just a shit storm going on around you, it gets really easy to kind of lose yourself in it and start thinking, oh, the thing that matters most is my relationship with this person, or the thing that matters most is that my peers like me, or the thing that matters most is that the public is saying good things about me, or the thing that, you know what I mean? Like it's really easy for that to happen in these jobs because you're under that kind of pressure all the time. And so, you know, it's easy to like inadvertently get into, you know, existing because you're trying to make the people on social media, you know, or somebody like you, you know, like we're back in third grade, you know,
right.
Because we all care about those things. I mean, I care about that. I still care about it. I care about it if people don't like me.
Right.
But, you know, but you have to sort of separate that from what is the mission I'm serving here? You know, who are the people that are at the center of that? And what do they need from me right now? And yeah. what's best for this mission? And then, you know, if, you know, somebody's mad at me, my peers don't like it, or the CEO doesn't like it, or, you know, then I guess that the chips will fall where they fall. And it doesn't right. mean you don't care about those people. You certainly do.
Right.
But I would say that advice, you know, over time has kind of become, it shows itself again as relevant advice and relevant things to think about mm-hmm. In trying to navigate all kinds of stuff that is usually involves other people and is usually hard mm-hmm. Because, you know, people are messy. So
I can't agree with you more on all of that. And which makes me think about one other conversation we had. So I'll pose one more question to you because your advice to me was just amazing. I was struggling with a really complex challenge, a big challenge that I was dealing with in my role here at the chamber. And we were sitting over lunch and I was trying to figure out how to solve this big elephant, you know?
Yeah, I remember the conversation.
Yeah. And you gave me such great advice. Can you go take us back to that afternoon and share a little
bit? I mean, I think what I would say about you in that is your ability to see the whole of a horizon and to see the possibilities of something, I think is extraordinarily remarkable. Mm-hmm. And because you can, and because you do, it sort of automatically frames things in a more complex way mm-hmm. than they would be framed if you took an overly simplistic view to something, or if you only thought the world was black and white, or there was only one variable. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So, I mean, the conversation was first and foremost a byproduct of the fact that you could see the whole of, and you do this, you see the whole of something, you see kind of the implications of it. And then you're trying to figure out, most often when I'm talking to you, you're trying to figure out how to move these sort of larger, complicated things mm-hmm. because you see them as larger, complicated things, which they are. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's a strength that ended up causing the conversation. So I would start with that. Some people aren't going to have the problem because they're going to think something that's inherently gray is black or white. And they're going to overly simplify it, or they're going to see something that's got a multitude of variables to it as a singular variable issue. Mm. And so in that case, my advice isn't going to be helpful to them. But for you, because of what I just said, I think I just said, I listened to you and I thought you had the problem assessed, at least from where I sit, really well. I could not for myself see a way to immediately solve for the whole of it either. And so I think I just said, you know, at least in my own life, sometimes when I can't figure out how to solve the whole of something, whether it's at work or in a relationship or whatever, I just try to like start with something I can solve in it, you know, or as I think Hubert is the one who used to say this, start by making the problem smaller. Like if you yes. can't solve it, you know, at least just take a piece of it that you think you can solve and just make the big problem smaller. And see if that can't get you somewhere. And, you know, a lot of times I think for people, especially who see sort of a whole system, they're a little reluctant sometimes just to try to solve a piece of it because they then think, well, I'm not solving all this other stuff,
right.
which is what you were getting a little bit wrapped up in. And it's
right.
like, oh,
right.
you'll probably solve the other stuff too. But why don't you just, I mean, if you didn't see the whole of the problem, then that's a risk, but you saw the whole of the problem. So, okay. So just solve the piece of it that you know how to solve, then you'll have a smaller problem and then get to work on that. And, you know, it, over time, it's, you know, sort of like picking a knot out of something. You know, over time, you'll get the knot picked apart, but, you know, take what it gives you to start with. I think that's generally pretty good advice.
Well, I just have to, I'm sure somebody listening to this podcast is going, that's it. I mean, just a path forward. You know, may not be the whole path, but it is a place to start. And the picking a knot thing really resonates with me too. So yeah, I just can't tell you how that has stayed with me, Cher, in very impactful ways. And so we're running out of time. I keep looking at my clock to get
this. Is like what happens. So much... This is what happens when we have lunch or breakfast.
I know. We're always
like, what?
We're late for already? The next meeting. Gotta go. Like, quick.
We just sat down.
So my final question for you, and I try to ask this of all of my guests, because I really would love to know your thoughts on this, but what would you describe as some character traits that define a good leader?
First of all, I do not believe in leaders are born, you know, or they're made. Like, I think it's a little bit of both. You know, I mean, I think you sort of have to have a proclivity to be a great leader. You have to have a kind of a proclivity to be interested in people. Mm. You know, I mean, like truly interested in people, including all the messy stuff that comes with people. Mm. I mean, it still sort of surprises me when I meet somebody who's got some big leadership job and they don't really like people. It's like, well, what are you doing?
I mean, yeah.
That's right. That's the job. Like, I know you're frustrated and you really hate people, but that's the job. So we got a little mismatch here. So I would say the first thing is, you know, like you have to genuinely appreciate and enjoy humanity on some level, I think, to be a great leader. So that's one. Two, I think you have to be more interested in learning and solving problems than you are having to be right about something, because it's just, you know, I mean, we've all been around people in leadership jobs who their identity is they're the smartest person in the room. And it's like, right. Well, if that's the case, why do you need me in here? You know, it's like, yes, you don't need me in here. If that's your role. So
yes.
I think you have to genuinely, you know, be more interested in sort of solving something cool with people and having your role adapt as needed versus being the smartest person in the room. You wouldn't know it from this podcast. Good Lord, because all I've done is talked. I've asked you no questions. But I think in real life, you know, your question to statement ratio needs to be offset in a way where you ask more questions than you make statements.
Right.
So I think great leaders generally have, you know, sort of a high question to statement, you know, ratio. And I think you have to like to learn. Mm. I mean, you really do. So yesterday, our the head groundskeeper at Allianz is a guy named Ryan Moy, and he's just I enjoy him to no end. But second of all, he's just fascinating. And I mean, even just like how he got to the job. But I'm super interested in what these guys do. So he's got a relatively small team. And these guys are like, they're equal parts scientists. You know, I mean, the things they know about soil and grass, I mean, there's a reason our field looks the way it does. I mean, these guys are geniuses, and I mean geniuses, but they're equal parts kind of scientists and artists. Mm-hmm. And so I got a text from Ryan, I think it was the end of last week, and he sent me a text saying, hey, the USA Cup is in Blaine right now, where just like tens of thousands of kids are here from all over the world for this massive soccer tournament. And so Ryan says, I'm going to be up there on whatever day yesterday was, Wednesday, watching a game on our new field. Do you want to come up and watch the game? Just maybe for like 45 minutes or something. We can watch kids playing on this field we built.
I said,
I'm going to be in Blaine. So yes, I would be happy to. So I'm sitting there yesterday with Ryan, you know, just on the berm in Blaine, watching these kids play soccer on this field that his team built. It's beautiful. Talk about field of dreams. Mm. And I'm picking Ryan's brain on all kinds of stuff about what's the soil like? And then, what's the soil like? What's your yard like? You know, and like, why does this field look like this? And this field looks like this, like, what's the difference? And then like, what happens with, and before you know it, it's to say, it's
and he's
like
would you
minutes.
Stop talking? I'm watching a soccer game.
Yeah, no, but he's great because he's a curious guy too, you know? But it's like, if you don't like listen to that story and go, what a great job.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we solve hard stuff too. It's hard to win in pro sports. And, you know, we have competitive people at the club and, you know, there's lots of stuff we don't like and our revenue is not what we want and we're not as big as we want to be. So it's a real job like that.
Right, right, right.
But if you can't find joy in it with people solving stuff, like with the Ryan Moys of the world, then you probably shouldn't be in the job. I guess that's what I would say.
That's amazing.
Those are the things. I mean, I think at least those things are sort of price of admission if you're going to be an effective and a happy leader. And I think ultimately to be effective over time, you have to be a happy person. Yeah, I think so.
So listeners, now you get just a glimpse of the awesomeness that is Sherry Ballard and why I pursue her to spend time with her. We have so much fun together. Sherry, I just love hearing how you view the world, you know, and I know that our others do as well. And so I'm really sorry that we've run out of time, but I want to thank you so much, dear friend, for talking with me.
Thanks for the invite. I enjoy you very much.
Oh, it was just great. And thank you for joining us for Beast Table Talk. And thank you again also to Wells Fargo, our sponsor. We have more conversations in the weeks ahead, probably not as amazing as this one, but we will be speaking to leaders in the region and hearing from them and their organizations and how they're investing in tomorrow. So thanks to all of you, and we will see you in the trenches. Bye, Cher.
See you, B.